Attention musicians of all levels. It's not always easy picking out a song by ear. Sometimes you need a little help. Well, I have the app for you. Whether you're a professional musician or a beginner, Ultimate Guitar is an amazing app. For just $2.99, you get the chords and tabs on guitar, bass, or ukulele for over a million songs. They're all available at your fingertips. You also get tools like a tuner, metronome, chord library, lessons, videos, and more. You can find out any song you want. It also has like transpose button. It has auto scroll that you can change the speed to so you can play along with the song. A lot of the songs have the lyrics there so you can sing along with them. Ultimate Guitar is an amazing app. Just go to ultimateguitar.com or download the app to your phone today and start playing. Start playing any song you want. Ultimate Guitar, that's the place for you. Let's get down. Hey gang, are you new to this podcast? Have you subscribed on Spotify, Stitcher, or Apple Podcasts and realized that you can only access the 20 most recent shows on these platforms? Do you, my friend, want to binge on How Did I Get Here? Well, check out our archives that are available on the Podbean app. If you follow us on the Podbean app, we have every single show ever released on that platform. You'll also get all of your favorite shows like Fresh Air, WTF with Mark Maron, ID10T, The Michelle Obama Podcast. All podcasts available there, and you can also access over 1,000 How Did I Get Here episodes. So, download the Podbean app from your app store and start listening today. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
Hello, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys have all had a good week. Boy, the weather sure got nice here in Austin. I got all the windows open, man. It's one of those like high pressure, cool days. It's breezy, no humidity. It's nice and cool in my place, man. You can hear, I think you can kind of hear the outside stuff going on. So you don't get those days a lot, you know, especially after like this, you know, things have been changing. Usually this kind of weather usually comes up 2 weeks earlier than it did this year. It usually starts coming in around my birthday, which is October 14th. Now we're here at the end of October. Of course, we got Halloween this weekend. I don't know if you guys are going to go out and get all dressed up and do the whole thing. Do it up out there. You going to get out there? Be Halloween-y? I'm not dressing up, but I did carve pumpkins last night with my girlfriend, Terry. We made this fantastic cauliflower rice and shrimp, had some wine, and carved pumpkins. Turned out great. In fact, you know, I haven't carved a pumpkin since I was a little kid, and I had a really good time doing it. I had a really good time doing it with Terry. Plus, we made pumpkin seeds; those were delicious. But I haven't done it, and it was literally I was a little bit intimidated before I stuck the knife in. I was like, "Shit, man, how am I going to control this knife while I'm cutting out this stuff?" But it's actually a lot easier than you think it is, and the pumpkin is a lot more forgiving of like a palate, if you will. Anyway. Great time carving pumpkins, getting ready for... We're not really doing a Halloween thing. I don't have a costume plan. We're going to go... I think Sunday we're going to take a little hike with the dog again, go out and find a place where we can go walk around. But Saturday night we're going to that new tiki place. You know what I'm talking about? By the same guys that have the ramen place, and they opened a tiki bar, and you have to make reservations a long time in advance, and it's supposed to be really cool. So we're doing that on Saturday. I'll let you know how it was on the show on Monday. I'm pretty excited about it, actually. Very excited to go to this tiki place. You know, man, it's interesting because as this relationship goes on, I'm learning, you learn how to be in a relationship better with every day. Every day, does that make sense? Like you start overcoming hurdles a little bit easier every time. You start understanding yourself in a relationship. You know, like you start understanding the other person, but you also have to have a little bit of understanding about yourself and what you bring to the table. You know what I mean? Because when you're by yourself for a long time, you don't realize what all you're bringing to the table. You don't realize the baggage that you just carry around naturally. You know what I mean? And so so this has been a great learning experience, and I think Terry and I are at a point in our lives where we do the learning and we work it out, and it ends up working out. We can do things like carve pumpkins and have a great time and have shrimp and cauliflower rice. You know what I mean? By the way, she was the one that cooked the pumpkin seeds, and she did it with just coconut oil and salt, and that was delicious. That's enough. So if you do carve a pumpkin, if you listen to this show and you're about to carve a pumpkin tonight or tomorrow night or whatever it is you do, I miss the candy on Halloween. I really do. You know what I don't miss is Monday morning, I'm going to get up and I'm definitely going to go to the grocery store and get half price, just at least one bag of candy. It's been hard, man. It's hard not to eat sugar, you know? And ever since I quit, it's been a couple months now that I've not smoked. And I can feel the weights come on after I had COVID. I haven't gotten back into a regular exercise routine, which I need to do. And I'm, you know, trying not to have sugar, but you crave sugar sometimes, you know, when you're me. Maybe you have it too, you know, like there's some stuff like you're like, oh shit, man, I'd really like some cookies right now. But what happens is I end up eating a whole thing of cookies or like too many cookies. I shouldn't have eaten that many cookies. So yeah, I've been craving sugar, trying not to eat it, but carving pumpkins is nice. Gang, I want to talk to you about something on a little more serious of a note. I came across something that happened for the first time with this show. Someone that was on this show a while back, a few years ago, Ken Stringfellow, a guy who I've had an email relationship with. I've never met him in person, but we've been emailing each other now for a few years. Some very, very, very serious allegations of sexual assault have come out against this guy. And his whole band quit. John Auger, who's been playing with him for years in the Posies, he quit. It's Ken Stringfellow for the Posies and REM and Big Star. Played with all these people. And these are very serious allegations. There's you can read the article. Just look it up. It's on, I think, KUOU is the radio station that actually, there's some people that work for it, did an investigative thing. They interviewed like 20 people. We just had Frankie Siragusa on the show, who plays drums with them. He was on because of a solo record that he made. And he and I have a relationship outside of the Posies, but he quit the Posies. And John Auger, as I said, quit the Posies. So, excuse me. When the band quits, you know for sure that that's, you know, those guys know what happens on the road. And, you know, they might have had an idea. Maybe this is going on. And then they're like, oh, okay. So it was going on. So anyway, I feel bad for those dudes. I'm bummed about Ken Stringfellow, and I just wanted to let you guys know that in the first time that I'm being faced with this, I'm taking down the Ken Stringfellow episode. And you know, that's how it goes, man. I'm bummed that he got away with this for so long, doing this to people. And I'm glad that we live in a time now when that kind of behavior can be pointed out. And people end up having to pay the price for the shitty things they do to other people. All right? So that's my story. You can read the story about Ken Stringfellow on there. I'm not being, I'm not trying to be salacious or gossipy or anything like that. This is a real story that's out there. This is a real thing that happened to real people. And it's awful. And I just want to let you guys know that as my audience, the first time that I'm being confronted with this, I'm taking down the episode and, you know, that's it for the Ken Stringfellow episode. All right? All right. Whew. Gang, I've got a great show for you today. I do. Art, folk, pop, composer, producer, singer, songwriter, performer, label owner, Rachel Sage is on the show today. You might know her from her solo career, putting out all these records. Her latest record, Character, came out in 2020. But she's got a brand new project. That is a spoken word concept album under the name Poetica. That's the name of the band, of the project. You can find them at poeticaproject.com. They just released their self-titled debut album last week. It's really, really great. I mean, it's really great. It's reminiscent of like a Leonard Cohen or Laurie Anderson, Patti Smith kind of thing. Empress Records, you know, I've had Seth Lear on here recently and also the great Grace Pettis, who lives here in Austin and is in Nobody's Girl. She's on Empress Records. But this album, Poetica, is available now on Empress Records. And this started out, Rachel Sage started doing this as a duo collaboration under quarantine with her longtime cellist, Dave Egger. And it's a cinematic music sounding thing, like the, all the music beds are very, very cinematic, very beautiful, and it is a spoken word concept album. Absolutely fantastic. You can find it wherever it is you stream and download your jams even your spoken word jams. Rachel and I have a great conversation about her journey through music, you know, becoming an artist, going to, like, she actually went to Stanford for theater, for drama and theater. And then she ended up getting in the School of American Ballet and being in the Actors Workshop. And then eventually starting this label to put out records of her own and other people's records. Empress Records, great, great label. You can find her at rachelsage.com. But you can find this new project that she has, Poetica Project, at poeticaproject.com. The record is called Poetica. Get out there and check it out. And please enjoy my conversation with the immensely talented and incredibly cool Rachel Sage. Let's get down.
There is something about the way you protect what I have all too often neglected that becomes rhapsodic to me. And in its magnanimity, a longing rises to let you let me love you allegiantly. A branch with blossom, a branch.
I'm somewhere in the middle of Pennsylvania.
Oh.
Halfway to my gig.
Halfway to your gig in Chicago, right?
We're playing in Spring Lake, actually, tomorrow.
Oh, okay. And then Chicago on Thursday?
Indeed. Would you like me to do video on this?
It would make it more fun for me. Yeah.
Sure. Let me just sort myself out. I literally, my violinist just flew out the door. We were rehearsing this morning. And here we go.
I saw a video. Oh, there you are. Hello. Oh, you look
Hello.
Like you.
Hello. Here I am.
Yeah. I saw a video of you guys rehearsing for your show at Rockwood. You sounded really great.
Right. Oh, thank you.
Let me
ask. It was
you.
On Instagram.
Yeah, yeah. I was wondering... normally you sing when you play, and that's what your Rachel Sage career has been like. But this
that's
is like
true.
A new foray into poems over soundscapes, right?
Say that's right. Yes.
Like that. Is it hard to, as a singer, is it hard to recite that stuff without, you know what I'm saying? Like, does it ever get weird? It has its own timing. It has its own melody without notes.
You know, through the years, I've actually occasionally done spoken word pieces interspersed into some of my normal Rachel Sage material. But it's been more of like a special occasion. You know, I would get up and do one piece like that, ask a drummer for a groove. And then there's a piece called Hit Song that I've done frequently. Live, and some people have requested it and asked if I could do more stuff like that. And I had another piece called Back to Freedom, another one called Marmalade. So I've done three or four on various albums through the years. But this was kind of an offshoot of me wanting to do an audio book for a pending poetry book while I was in lockdown. And I just had this one microphone and no musicians and just my little lonesome isolated self. So it was a way to be creative and start layering my own percussion, and the additional music really just grew from that. So it was a very unexpected project. So what you're asking about, is it hard to not sort of dip into singing instead of speaking? It was kind of all gravy. I don't know if you had anything like that during lockdown where you were just making the most with your limitations. And then sometimes those limitations can yield a silver lining, which for me was a whole entire new project. And it is very much spoken word with soundscape kind of elements. And I'm just really excited about it because I never anticipated I would do something like this. And I thought at my ripe mid-age, you know, I might not get any more vast musical surprise. So I'm very grateful that it all happened.
Yeah, well, first of all, the album's great, and I'm glad that you mentioned the percussion because that's one of the things about it that I just loved. Like,
I was playing myself. That sounds wrong on a podcast, but I was doing a lot of like Bobby McFerrin, kind of just playing my chest, you know, a lot of finger snaps, hand claps. This was like what I did to make a shaker. Oh. Your viewers can't see me, but they can hear.
Together. Yeah.
Yeah. There's all kinds of crazy stuff.
It's interesting because I just did this interview last week with a woman named Marcia Pally. She also lives in New York. She's a she teaches at NYU and at Fordham. And she wrote this book about Leonard Cohen's writings.
Wow.
With his religion versus politics versus culture. And so how he has these battles within these songs and all that stuff. So I spent a lot of time last week listening to a lot of Leonard Cohen in a whole new way.
Wow.
And so I was really excited to go back and listen because Jill had sent me your record a little while back and I had listened to it and I was like, oh, this is cool. Yeah, man, let's have her on. Then I go, listen to all this stuff. And then I was like, oh, that's what the Poetica album is like. And so I went and listened to it. It's nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a good bit of his spirit in it, I think, and some Patti Smith and Tom Waits
right.
and Ricky Lee Jones. You know, I love music from, you know, the retro eras that now that they're deemed as such. But for me, it's the time that I think I would have been most, you know, comfortable with. I'm a singer-songwriter at heart, but I also have this kind of beatnik, you know, free-spirited hippie chick in me. I don't know if it's because I spent all that time out in the Bay Area, but probably. But yeah, I love the 60s and the 70s. And actually, Leonard Cohen's last live concert was probably the best concert I've ever seen in my entire life. And it was such a beautiful mix of, you know, his songs and his poetry. His longtime accompanists were extraordinary. And it really felt like sort of a jumping off point for me for this project in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. You probably know, do you know Roscoe Beck and like Mitch Watkins and Raphael Gale?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're all guys that have been around for a while.
Where are you based again?
In Austin.
Oh, right. Right. Yeah. Oh, I love Austin. I miss it. Hopefully we'll be back in the spring.
Yeah. So you're on tour right now for quite a while, huh? For the rest of the month?
Not too long. A couple of weeks. Okay. Yeah. I do a week
a while
and then I go home.
Compared to the last year and a half, yeah. Right?
Listen, it's all, you know, it's so amazing just to not be in my own apartment and to be on the road with my wonderful violinist, Kelly Halloran, who plays beautifully on this album. And my beloved tour manager, Meredith, we're a family and we've missed each other so much. So, you know, the minivan antics are abounding and it's so great to even be doing hotel rehearsals.
Right. So on stage, it's just you and the violinist?
For this particular stretch. And then the next bunch of shows in the South, I'm going to be joined by my Poetica
ensemble.
Collaborator and co-writer, Dave Eggar. And he is just absolutely a genius. And he helped arrange a lot of the strings on this album and was just so incredibly encouraging of me going down this rabbit hole of really, really focusing on the poems and making sure all of the, you know, the music and the percussion served the words. He's a real stickler for that. He went to Harvard. He's, you know, a real dummy. But sometimes he would be very disciplined and he would say, you know, this part is great. This is cool. But it's getting in the way of me understanding what you're saying. So nope, let's lose that. I'd be like, really? Are you sure? It sounds so cool. He's like, yep. He was very protective, which I really appreciated.
Yeah. There has to be that sort of thing where it's funny. I hate to keep referencing it, but I just went so deep last week on Leonard Cohen. I listened to this interview with Patrick Leonard, who produced a lot of stuff for him, right? Mm-hmm. As well as some of Madonna's best hits.
Right. I was going to say Leonard Cohen and Madonna. Yeah.
And he was saying that there was a thing where not the music is secondary, but like the voices is up here and the music's mm-hmm. down here. You know what I mean?
That was a bit new for me for this because I'm very much a like kitchen sink kind of producer. I love the Beatles. I want to try every idea I have and try to make them all work typically. And that's worked pretty well for me, you know, through the years on a lot of my pop stuff. But that wasn't really the approach with this at all. It was building around the voice. And in a lot of ways, I do think my experience as a singer in the studio helped me devise ways of layering the spoken voices yeah. on these tracks in a way that hopefully holds people's interest
yeah.
and plays with stereo imaging and things like that.
It really does. And it's fun to listen to like on that level as well. It does keep you engaged sonically like that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Listen, we were all just making it up as we went during this crazy time. So the idea that I could record, you know, on my little laptop, I literally put it all on an ironing board. I was renting this quirky Airbnb in the pandemic because I didn't want to go back to the city, New York.
Where were you?
And we were in the middle of a tour when all of this happened with Howard Jones. And I was out with Dave Eggar. Yeah. From the 80s, my friend Howard.
He's your friend?
Yeah. He's just the loveliest person. And we were in Pittsburgh when, you know, the rest of our tour got the unceremonial kibosh like every other musician on the planet. And suddenly I didn't know where to go. I ended up going back to New Haven with my tour manager and renting an Airbnb right across the street from her just to be near my buddy, you know, because we didn't know what was going on. We were also scared and nervous to go back to New York, which was then the epicenter of everything. And I hung out there for months. And then I eventually made my way, I know, in this attic apartment above a Yale professor and his newborn baby. It was very Anne Frank. I was like listening to his and his wife's conversation through the floorboards, the baby's crying in the hallway. And I was thinking, is there a way I can incorporate this and put it all
was
into
there
the
a
work?
Way? Did you?
A little bit. Okay. Just a little bit. I'm not going to say, I don't want him to sue me, but they were very nice people. They put up with my noise. So it was reciprocal.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a strange time. But somehow through all of it, I was able to send these files back and forth to Dave and Kelly and innumerable other musicians across the country.
You had a lot of musicians, but they're all like champions. Stallions of
music. Of my favorites, yeah.
Yeah.
But sweet, really nice, lovely mensch people. I'm telling you, life is too short. I love to play with people who are just great human beings, and it makes it so much more joyful. So, you know, just emailing with some of these folks, just the excuse to engage and touch base with them and talk on the phone was revelatory, because all of a sudden I had something I was working on. Whereas before it felt like I was waiting, you know, I'm waiting for gigs to come back. I'm waiting to get back into the studio and play my pop music with my regular band. Yeah. And this felt like a window kind of opening into a new realm that I could just be present in it and not, you know, kind of tangled up in knots over when regular life would begin. It was a different perception of the world and myself and some of these collaborators. And here we are about to play it for audiences. It's very exciting.
Yeah, that is really exciting. It's weird to think about some of these things that happened during this lockdown that might not have happened if...
Absolutely. The list is long for me. I don't know about for you, my friend. There are quite a number of things that wouldn't have happened. I don't think I ever would have live streamed. And yet I did.
Oh, no, I would have never live streamed.
Hundreds and hundreds of them every Sunday, every Wednesday for months. I was improvising off the top of my head, playing like, you know, 10-minute piano improvs, just, you know, just kind of taking chances because I knew that it was ironically a very safe space, even though I'm putting it out there potentially for many more people to hear. But it really felt like, you know, listeners were just so eager and grateful to have artists step up and show up and be consistent. So
that was the thing that I obviously I wasn't doing it for myself. It started kind of to become a thing that was really fun and I could kind of challenge myself in my own way to do it. But I noticed I did a month, like every week for a month, and I was like, I'm going to take a month off. People got really bummed out.
I got upset. I know.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt bad.
True. But it makes you feel good that they really miss you. And, you know, it you have to kind of take care of yourself and make sure your own mental health is in order. But, you know, I'm a big believer in taking breaks and coming back. But there was something about the ritual and the discipline of showing up every week that I felt was very mutually sustaining and good for the community in terms of the music.
Right. And good for your mental health too, to have that. Cause there was a thing that went out the window. Like you didn't know what time it was. Like when it first went down and you're like, well, I mean, is it cool if I just watch movies all day on a Tuesday? You know what I mean? Like, no one's really doing anything, or it was so odd.
And I also run a record label. I have a staff, and we were all working remotely and working with other artists. And, you know, the unexpected thing was that all of my artists were so prolific, so creative. They were cranking out new singles and new EPs and albums. And we were really, you know, just kind of scrambling to keep up with the output and this prodigious creativity that was happening. I wasn't necessarily in that place initially. I was barely writing songs. So again, when I did find this project to help focus me, it was, you know, it was a great thing for me. And I really am just starting to get back into writing songs again. I really needed some time to kind of process the changes in the world and the, you know, social strife and global anxiety that was going on, to feel like I knew what I wanted to say and how I could be of service as an artist.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to talk to you for a minute about Empress Records, because I've had a couple of your artists on here. Grace Pettis, who's a friend of mine from here in
wonderful.
Austin, and Seth Glear.
Yay!
It's really fantastic.
It's Grace's birthday today.
It is
Happy
Grace's birthday today. Yeah. And in our conversation, she told me the sort of the experience from like how this went for her, and how gracious you and your team were to believe in her and not just dump her when the shit went down, so to speak. You know what I mean? And I was
she made that easy. She is just extraordinary. And, you know, I think we pushed each other to not be complacent and not kind of completely freak out. And music was our collective salvation during this time. But we always appreciate how gracious and, you know, humble she is, but as you know, she is an extraordinary talent and
extraordinary,
very much merits, you know, that, that support from our end.
Yeah. And that album was totally worth making, you know?
Yes. Working Woman. Beautiful album. Seth too. You know, he has a gorgeous new album.
Gorgeous record.
And I don't know when he was on your, when was he on your show?
It was like
it recently.
I think it was like a month ago. I don't know.
Okay.
I think so.
He's out there touring and putting out beautiful new videos. And he is just so prolific and always pushes himself. Every album is just a bit different. And I'm always so proud of him because he just continues to grow. And I think he's one of the great songwriters of our time, really. That's just, you know, of course I'm biased, but that's how I feel.
It's so funny because I've never met anybody in your position at a label that doesn't have that weird kind of like feet on the desk, smoking a cigar, listen to you, kid, you know what I mean? Kind of thing.
What?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So it seems like you take very artistic chances, especially yourself, like this Poetica record. There might've been a part of you that was like, you know, cause your stuff was is relatively pop. It's like,
that's
like
true.
Indie pop.
Folk pop.
Yeah.
Pretty accessible. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love
a good melody.
Yeah. Yeah, you can tell. And so you're definitely you're taking the risk of taking a step in a direction that isn't your normal.
You know what's interesting is yes, I appreciate you saying that. I suppose I'm taking a risk sharing it and putting it out there. But on the flip side, you know, in college I wrote scores for innumerable theatrical productions. And by rote, I don't mean write out notation. I play by ear. But at that point in my life, I was very steeped in technology. I was a MIDI kid and I had synthesizers and all these modules and drum machines. And it's sort of the opposite of where my career ended up in terms of really writing very organic, acoustic based, you know, often rootsy material. So I found my way to that place very slowly by virtue of the music I came to love myself, like Sean Colvin and Ani DiFranco and, you know, all this stuff from the 70s. But initially, I was a very techie kind of a kid. And a lot of the music I wrote for theater was way out there. You know, these were theatrical cues for Shakespeare, for people entering and leaving the stage. And, you know, my influences in that realm were people like Philip Glass and John Zorn and artists who melded neoclassical with jazz. But I didn't really understand that's what they were doing because I didn't listen with that kind of intellectual approach. I just would go to see theater at the New York Public Theater or, you know, Shakespeare in the Park. And that's what I would hear. I would hear these underscored moments of text, often Shakespeare and then other contemporary plays. And I would think, oh, that's interesting. It's not, it's more than sound design. There's music here. It's not exactly telling you what to think, but it's helping further the emotion and the action. And I always thought in the back of my mind, that's a legit job I could do. Like if I couldn't be, you know, a pop star on stage. And I was thinking this at age 15, 16, 17, going to see theater in New York. So, you know, that all that stuff was in there. It was just sort of boxed away while I pursued this career as a singer-songwriter on stage and touring. So I think part of it was just having the time, you know, having the time to get weird again a little bit and not judge it too much, not have people say, oh, that won't get on the radio or what have you. So, silver lining for sure.
Yeah. Totally. So, so where are you from? Where were you born?
I was born in Portchester, New York.
Okay.
And I grew up in different parts of Connecticut. And then I moved back to the city right after college, which I went to Stanford. So I was in the Bay Area near San Francisco, which was a big influence on me and, you know, steeped myself in a lot of blues and acoustic music while I was out there and completely did a 180 musically.
So, but was that where you were doing like the scores for theater and stuff?
At school, yeah. I mean, I was going to do anything to avoid having to just major in something normal and, you know, actually open a lot of books. So I managed to be a theater major and my emphasis was composing music for theater.
Okay.
So, you know, I did a lot of that and people just started to think of me as the chick who could write music for plays. And I had all my MIDI equipment and I would, you know, bring it to the stage. You know, there'd be a table in the wings and I would be scoring these things. And the director would say, yes, no, you know, bring that back tomorrow, put a groove to it. You know, it was very,
it's kind of cool.
Very spontaneous. And very experimental in a lot of ways. And I left most of that behind when I came back to New York and just started pounding the pavement, playing places like The Bitter End and Cafe Chanet with Jeff Buckley. And, you know,
you were playing there at the time that he was playing?
Yeah. Yeah. Like I lived across the street from Cafe Chanet and I was there all the time at all hours and just loved that scene. I miss it. That was a really idyllic time in indie music in New York.
I haven't found
anything that's replaced it, but I love that time period. And I often think about those days when I was schlepping my keyboard on a trolley down the block.
Yeah.
You know,
I remember playing Rockwood a few times, like 10 and 15 years ago over the course of a bunch of years and thinking that that place was having that kind of cool vibe.
Oh, did you think that? Love Rockwood. Yeah. I just played there last week. I did my album release there.
Yeah.
I love Ken Rockwood. He is just an incredible human being and scene maker. And I give him enormous credit for somehow sustaining these various venues through this crazy time. So it's a real testament to his, just his popularity and the way that he's treated artists through the years, that those establishments are still there. So yeah, yay, Ken.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So wait a minute. Let me just go back and make sure that you're your major in Stanford was drama, theater.
Drama.
And, but
with an emphasis in like music for theater. So I wrote my thesis on Brecht and his use of music. And, you know, you have to make it intellectual to graduate, but really all I was interested was how can music support the action and the storytelling? And, you know, it became a kind of metaphor, I guess, for how to approach songwriting once I emerged into the choir world. You know, how can the stories and the songs that I'm writing be relevant and support people who are coming to listen to them and, you know, tell a kind of a story of the fabric of society and further empathy and inclusiveness. And that's kind of where I've been at all these years.
That's amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what were you doing when you were playing at Shinee? What was your thing?
Oh my goodness.
Jeff Buckley's thing was electric guitar in an amp by himself, which is not something you see very often.
I know. I had a band called Rachel Sage and the Red Rubber Band. And I had some phenomenal musicians and it was very quirky and eclectic. I had a drummer named Dave Rosenberg who played this teeny tiny, adorable little kit, kind of fashioned off when Crowded House would be on TV and only play with a snare.
Right.
You know,
right.
That kind of thing. Yeah. I loved the unplugged drum approach. And if you got too loud, I'd get scared, you know.
Can I interrupt you really fast?
Oh, yeah, please.
Are you talking about their performance of the song Sister Madeleine on David Letterman?
I love that one, too. But I think it was something on the Grammys,
okay.
Actually.
Or right, go ahead. Sorry.
Even the MTV Awards, where they walk through the audience with the marching snare and it's hanging around his neck. Yeah. That kind of thing. Yeah. But I love it all. They're my favorite. And then I had Mike Visaglia was playing bass with me at the time. And he's since toured with Suzanne Vega quite a bit. Very sensitive, melodic, fretless player. I had a violinist named Carol Scherer who continues to play and do wonderful work. An accordion player, Rob Curdo, he's phenomenal. And that was, oh yes. And Ben Butler on guitar. He played acoustic and electric with me. And then I had my painted keyboard. I played a little guitar at that point, but nothing too adventurous, but it was all about dynamics and really having each song kind of take people on this, you know, wide-ranging journey. So I wanted every song to be like a little movie. And I remember being such a crazy stickler at that time in my life for beginnings and endings and the dynamics and how loud things got, how soft things got. And I probably was a bit annoying as a band leader because it was all about the details for me at that time. I'm not quite as much like that anymore, but in my 20s, I was very particular.
Well, I mean, in pop, you kind of have to be, you know?
Well, thanks for letting me off the hook.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Okay. So were there like once, I'm sorry to keep going back to this, but once Jeff Buckley got signed from there, I know how these scenes work. All of a sudden, like the guy from Columbia that signed Jeff, like his underling is there at your show at Shinee, because they're looking for the next person to bring out of Shinee to put on the MTV or whatever.
That's true. There was a lot of that. And there was a moment around then when I was approached by Interscope Records. It was an interesting kind of concurrence of very polar energies and events. So on the one hand, I was invited to tour with Ani DiFranco after I sent her my song, Sister Song, which was very much about her influence on me and her particular brand of feminism, which really resonated. And as someone who's also out as being bi, you know, she really just resonated with me as well. So that was one side of my life. And then in that same moment, because of what you're describing, that scene downtown and how much I was playing, I was approached by Interscope. I was brought in to meet with and perform for Tom Wally.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a crazy time, but I also knew like that the reason I was invited to tour with Ani was because I was staunchly indie and doing my own thing and
right.
So I was conflicted. And I also was really figuring out who I was, what I wanted to do. I was very much afraid that I could get signed and lost in that machine.
Yeah.
And I had heard through the grapevine that the A&R guy, I'm not going to mention who it was, but the A&R guy who was very nice, who wanted to work with me, was perhaps not going to be there much longer.
Yeah.
And that proved to actually be the case. So he was kind enough to take me out to, I think it was sushi, the cliche. And he was like, listen, you may be better off hanging on to your masters, putting out this record you've made, which was Smashing the Serene, my second record. He said, I've just had to drop these three artists. The budgets weren't there. They're making a lot of changes. I would just hang out, do your thing, and let's keep in touch. And I had the opportunity to work with Interscope with the other folks who had already heard me. And I got cold feet and I just backed out of the whole situation. I went on tour with Ani. I came back and doubled down with Empress Records and everything I was doing and kind of didn't look back. So that's what happened.
You had put your first record out on Empress Records? Like that's how it started, you putting out your records.
If you could call it putting it out. I mean, I pressed up a bunch of copies. I would stick them into folders and bring them to venues and sold them on CD Baby. So that was before I had distribution and all that kind of thing.
That's a great story, man. I love someone that sticks to their guns. And even though I've been in that situation where I've had to step away from something like that, that you've been working towards your whole life. You know what I mean? You're like, oh, this is what I want. And then you're like, no, this isn't going to work out. I don't think.
I saw a lot of my peers being sort of unceremoniously dropped. It was a very prolific time for major labels to be dropping artists. My dear friend, Patty Rothberg, who I thought was having an extraordinary amount of success. I mean, I went to hear her play at like the Z100 Jingle Ball. She was playing her top 40 hit, had an album out Between the One and the Nine. It was brilliant. And she was playing with people like the Bengals. And she was dropped. It was so strange to me. So this whole phenomenon of that you could sign these contracts, spend all this money making your records, be beholden to the albums to the labels for years and years, not be able to even put out those records yourself. It made me, afraid of it. And I suppose that fear drove me to try to build my own thing. And, that's what I've been doing ever since. But yeah, it was an interesting time. And, I don't look back and judge that young gal. If I had decided to go that route, I think really interesting things might have happened as well. But for whatever reasons, it didn't work out. And a lot of other doors were opening at the same time that seemed to be saying, keep growing, keep developing, and don't let them throw you into that generic machine where the same three people will produce you who produce this litany of other pop artists. Yeah. So that's really what it was. I was a control freak. I knew they didn't want me to produce myself. And I kept hearing some catchphrases. Oh, you could be the next Alanis at the piano. You could be the next Ani at the piano. I was like, I don't know.
Yeah. It's funny because you came in at if the time that you're talking about, that's like the dawn of Lilith as well.
That's right.
Which
I loved. I mean, I had a wonderful experience at Lilith Fair, and I can't ever say enough about just how mindful and generous Sarah McLachlan and her whole team were, how beautifully presented that event was. They were like thank you notes from Sarah handwritten in our green rooms.
Right.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
That doesn't happen anymore. It really, everything from beginning to end about that.
So you went on it? Festival.
Yeah. I did some shows and, it was right at the end of it, 1999. after winning like a local New York contest. I kind of clawed my way into it. But everyone, whether you were on the little stage, the village stage, she treated everyone so beautifully. And it really was a feeling of community and, you know, just kind of showing that, yes, women can, you know, can draw, and it shouldn't be this anomaly that women are headlining festivals.
Yeah.
So I think she did a lot to change the landscape, and, you know, I love her. So yay, Sarah. Yeah.
All right. So all that happened, and you just kind of, how did you end up building Empress into a label that you could sign other people and everything?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think when I first got distribution, which by the way was sort of a random thing of like me sending my album to college radio, it charted very well. And then out of nowhere, a distributor called Big Daddy called me on the phone. I had my phone and my fax number listed. They were, of course, the same thing, and it would switch over. You know, I had one of those fax machines that you could call out on it. And I had given myself a fake name as a manager to represent myself on all my press kits, as people did back then. And I was Jennifer, and Big Daddy called Jennifer to see if Empress Records would like to be on their roster. And they had seen you Smashing the Screen charting in the top 100 on CMJ or something. And so I put on my best professional voice and called this guy, Bert Goldstein, back. And, you know, I was a little dubious. He sounded like a real old time music guy. And
even his name.
There were a few things. I know.
You want to get played on the radio, kid? You got to talk to Bert Goldstein.
Kind of like that. Yeah. He's like, I heard you on CMJ. You know, you need a distributor. What do you think of this cut, this split, blah, blah, blah. So I quickly called someone who was a lawyer and worked out some details. And before I knew it, I was on Big Daddy Distribution. And, you know, a couple of years went by. I was cranking out my own thing. I did some more touring. I was applying to festivals, and I had an intern by then. There was a manager who wanted to kind of get her experience with indie artists. So she was volunteering to help me. But I was just pounding the pavement in New York, going to singing lessons, all of that. And then one day I was on tour and I saw this young man, Seth Glear, and he was opening for me in New Hampshire, and he blew my gestalt, as we say. I just thought, I was like, wow, he's Billy Joel and James Taylor and Bruce Springsteen reborn, you know, and the world needs this. The world needs to hear him. He's like hidden away and in these tiny little folk venues. So I got this grandiose idea that I would sign him to my label, and the folks who I was working with at the time, you know, I gently coaxed them into this concept. And you know, we'd had kind of a courting process where we hung out at Folk Alliance, and then at South by Southwest, we took him out to dinner and just said, hey, we'd love to work with you. Would you like to be on Empress? And before we knew it, we had a contract, and we were in the studio kind of revamping one of his albums and working on the next. And, you know, a year or two later, we were at the Grammys, and it was very strange, you know, but it really just did come from, I have no choice. I have to do this kind of a thing, which is the best place I think to work from. Instinct, right?
Yeah. But what an interesting instinct to have while that whole establishment was crumbling.
let's put it this way. Through the years, there had been innumerable people who had approached me and asked if I could help them with their marketing or help them with this or that. And I really felt like I'm not in any position to do what you're asking. I'm really struggling. I'm trying to get myself heard. I'm, you know, happy to be working these long 20-hour days for myself, but how much less sleep can I get?
Right,
you know?
Right.
So I think at the point when I saw Seth and I was with my tour manager, Meredith Tarr, who is now A&R at Empress Records, I was just at that point where I felt like I'd come into my own. I had a certain stride going as a touring artist. And I, you know, it's that feeling like okay, my mask is on. Now I can help the child next to me. You know, not that I just mean you have to have taken care of yourself and have certain ducks in a row and solid before you can extend any kind of resources to anyone else. And my manufacturer, my distributor were very, very pleased because they had many times said, you know, you should really put out some other artists on your label. You could do that. And I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I know how, if I have it together. So I think the timing was just really great. And his sensibility was so aligned with mine. And all of the things that I had learned to promote myself completely applied to him. It wasn't like I was signing, you know, a jazz remixer or, you know, I just, I knew how to promote what he did. It was very similar to what I did. And yeah, it just worked out. So we've made a bunch of records together and he just keeps growing and pushing his own boundary. So very proud of him.
That's amazing. You've done such a great job with it. And what I was going to say is that, yeah, your instincts were right, but even at a time when all signs were pointing, like, don't start a label. Like,
Yeah, that's true. Although when I started the label in earnest in 2000, or I think right after Lilith, I just didn't have any other artists, but I was doing compilations.
Oh, okay.
So I was having a lot of indie artists submit, and I would do this through Sonic Bids. And then each compilation was for a different charity. They were called New Arrivals. So we would do a volume for World Hunger Year or one for National Eating Disorders Association. They were very diverse organizations. And that did kind of help me have my tentacles out in the indie scene. And there would be 13 to 20 artists on each album. So that was kind of a baby step toward signing someone else.
You're such a cool person. Yeah.
I think, Mike, thank you.
Yeah.
Likewise.
Yeah, that's just amazing. Like, so now how many artists do you have on Empress?
Let's see. We've got Grace Pettis, Seth Clear, A Fragile Tomorrow, who are a brilliant kind of power pop alternative band. And then we also work individually with some of the members of that band as solo artists, Sean Kelly and Dom Kelly. And another project called Cash Out. So a handful. It's not a zillion, but we were able to really give a lot of focus and attention. And most of our artists put out a release every year. So, you know, there is a lot in the pipeline already. Everybody's making new records.
Yeah. So your team is just kind of working round the clock, not round the clock, but round the calendar year.
That's true. Right. Yes.
Okay. So you said you're going to go on another leg of this tour?
Yes, I'm going to go home for a few days, have a few family events happening, and then we are out again with Dave Eggar is going to join myself and Kelly Halloran. So it'll be a string section, and we're going to be in Nashville.
How do you
and
do? Do you? What do you do during those things when they're playing the like, how do you handle the percussive aspect of it? Do you do it or do you play to some tracks?
I'm going to do some of it. I've brought some ham percussion with me on this tour. I'm going to throw in a little harmonica, which I also played a bit of on the record. And I was just rehearsing with Kelly, and I think I may actually add some piano harmony to a few of the poems once I have them more memorized in my head. So I couldn't really do that initially because I was reading, you know.
Right, right.
But now, at the 800th time I've recited these poems, I'm finally memorizing them. So my memory isn't what it used to be, and I'm very open about it. There's nothing I can do, but
I think those
once
things
I know
just
it.
Happen. So after not playing for a year, is going out playing shows, do you feel it? Because I did.
Interesting. You know, the very first one I did was, which was with Grace in New Haven. I did feel a little shaky and my voice felt a little raw by the end of the night, but that was more from the talking afterwards, you know, yelling at people through masks.
Right.
Everybody wants to connect, you know, and even when we would wander outside, it was like, hey, how have you been? You know, everybody's yelling. And that hurts my voice a lot. But by the second show, you know, I really felt like I settled in and I don't know. I was just so excited to be back on stage playing for an audience. And it really felt like, you know, I was eager to relish every moment of it, much in the way that, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I'm a cancer thriver.
And 3 years ago,
in 2018, I was diagnosed with uterine cancer, but I am absolutely fine now. I want to assure your listeners, I've had my third clean scan, so I'm in remission.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. Yay for my medical team. They have been amazing. But yeah, it's that same kind of thing where it's like you can either obsess over how out of shape you are, or you can just be excited to be in the moment and kind of play from that place of gratitude where there are no mistakes, there is no wrong.
Right.
And everything you're doing is magic, because in a way it really is. It's magic just to be alive. It's magic to wake up in the morning and not have any pain, you know? So I wanted to take that, just that kind of visceral appreciation for just being alive and translate that into a musical experience. So I'm still kind of riding that wave, trying not to be complacent. And, yeah, I feel like that's my superpower these days.
Yeah. People should check out maybe some people in my audience don't know you, they should check out your last record as a solo artist, Character. Mm-hmm. That's the one I listened to, all of it. It's really great.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. That really was a reaction to my recovery from cancer. The idea of distilling Character into an album and exploring that on every level was spurred from my experience of struggling with my own character, trying to be the very best patient I could possibly be for myself and also for those around me who were helping me. And also witnessing, you know, the incredible character and courage around me of fellow, you know, patients and survivors. So, I'm sending away housekeeping. No, thank you. I'll be out of the room in a few minutes. This is what it is. I've got 10 minutes to vacate the premises.
All right. Well, this record, Poetica, it'll be out by the time this comes out. It's fantastic. Yes. People can find out where you're playing and everything by going to poeticaproject.com and find out more about you and your own music at rachelsage.com. And of course, Empress Records and the great roster of talent that you have, including my dear friend, Grace Pettis.
Hey, Grace.
Before you go, I'm going to San Jose on Saturday. Did you ever hang out there?
Yes, I actually used to go and listen to Ray Manzarek accompany Michael McClure doing his poetry there. And that was one of the influences on me doing this kind of thing. Yeah, I met him. He was super nice. We went out for lunch.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I was a huge fan of The Doors. So that was a deeply embedded memory in my college experience, even though I got in trouble for cutting class, but it was all worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Wow, that was a great...
Enjoy San Jose. San Jose is great.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. Enjoy your tour. Be careful out there. Thank you for taking the time to do this. I'm glad it worked out. And it's been really great meeting you. You are a really, really cool person.
Well, let's stay friends.
Yeah.
If there's a word in Yiddish, I'm going to give it to you. You can do with it what you like. It's called mishpacha. It means family, chosen family. So,
mishpacha.
Welcome.
Yeah. Thank you. It's great talking to you.
Thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
This will pass. And our this will be grounded in a kiss.
Whether it's yours on mine.
That's Rachel Sage, the album Poetica. That's the name of the project as well. You can find them at poeticaproject.com. The album is out. You can get out there and listen to it wherever it is you stream and download your record, your music, your records. Go to the digital record store, download your record, and rock out to your record. That's all I've got to say. You can find her at poeticaproject.com and rachelsage.com. Empress Records is her label. Great, great label. Great artists on there. Of course, you've heard my conversations with Seth Gleer and the great Grace Pettis. We have great talk about Grace Pettis on there, right? Anyway, Rachel's fantastic. Check out Poetica. Don't forget, when you're out there, checking out poeticaproject.com and rachelsage.com, that you can find this podcast wherever it is you stream and download podcasts. New shows all the time. We're going to have 3 shows next week. Sorry there were only 2 this week, but there'll be 3 next week, and then we'll go back to our 2 a week thing. Great conversation with Rachel Sage. Get out there. Check out our podcast. Check out more episodes if you can. All right? Have a great day, whatever it is you're doing. Great weekend. Happy Halloween. Ooh, let's get down.
Something I believe one can strive for as much as allow. Your voice, a new kind of dew. Your voice, a new kind of dew. Appearing in my dreams. Whispering magenta and blue.